should have a free democratic society where people participate in the decisions that matter to them. They should be in control of social, economic, political institutions. Working stakeholders, workers and communities should run, manage, organize enterprises. There should be a free associations making arrangements with one another at from the local to the international level, searching for, focusing crucially on the basic problems that really are problems of survival.
That's Noam Chomsky, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Noam Chomsky on Utopia. In the darkest of times, we have to imagine a brighter tomorrow, of a world of equality and environmental and social justice. Are we dreamers, not practical, out of touch with reality? Out of touch with the real world? Out of touch with reality? Perhaps. Progressive change happens when people rise up and struggle for it. Throughout history, it has been small groups of visionary activists who ignite the flame and light up the darkness and show us the way forward. In Howard Zinn's masterwork, A People's History of the United States, he closes with these lines from the poet Shelley, which were recited by women garment workers to one another in New York sweatshops a century ago. "Rise like lions after slumber, in unvanquishable number. Shake your chains to earth like dew, which in sleep had fallen on you. Ye are many, they are few." Our guest today is Noam Chomsky, the legendary MIT professor who practically invented modern linguistics. In addition to his pioneering work in that field, he's been a leading voice for peace and social justice for many decades. Business Week says of him, "With relentless logic, Chomsky bids us to listen closely to what our leaders tell us and to discern what they are leaving out. Agree with him or not, we lose out by not listening." At 88, he's still active lecturing and writing. He's the author of scores of books, including his latest, Who Rules the World? I talked with him in his office at MIT. Well, once again, welcome to the program.
Glad to be with you again.
Well, there were two major events on November 8th. One, obviously, the U.S. election, which Der Spiegel had a cover story, Das Ende der Welt, the end of the world, with a Trump caricature depicted as a meteor hurtling toward Earth, his mouth wide open to devour it. But talk about the second major event, which hardly got any coverage whatsoever.
The second major event, which I believe was much more important, had to do with the survival of organized human life. It was a meeting of 200 countries in Marrakesh, Morocco. The meeting, it's called COP22, was a follow-up to COP21, the Paris negotiations of December 2015. The Paris negotiations intended to reach a verifiable treaty, international treaty, on measures to deal with the very real and urgent crisis of environmental catastrophe. They were unable to do that because the Republican Congress in the United States was unwilling to accept any binding commitments. So they ended up with a verbal agreement to do things, but not spelling it out. The Marrakesh meeting was intended to spell it out, for countries to commit themselves to specific measures which might deal with the very urgent and significant problem. That's far more important than the U.S. elections. The survival of the species is at stake. November 7th, the meeting opened. Normal way. November 8th, the World Meteorological Organization presented its report on the current state of what's called the Anthropocene, the geological epoch in which humans are drastically modifying the environment. And it was a pretty dire report. It reported that that every year is hotter than the last. Arctic ice has receded about 30% below the norm, which means that there's less reflection of solar rays and more absorption of sun rays, so it leads to an escalating impact on global warming. Pointed out that the goal of COP21, Paris, rise in temperature not beyond 1.5 degrees centigrade is already being approached. We're just about there, the ultimate goal. So a little more and we're over it. A little higher than that is expected to be irreversible. And other dire predictions of that kind. That was November 8th. Then the conference went into suspension while everyone watched the results of the election. November 9th, the conference basically collapsed. The only question on the minds of the delegates was, will the whole project survive the likelihood that the most important country in the world will pull out? And the conference basically ended without issue, nothing much except verbal commitment, so nothing was achieved. But the spectacle was pretty astounding when you look at it. There's 200 countries, practically the whole world. They're looking for a leader to lead the way to decent survival. Who? China. China is the leader that they're expecting to somehow save civilization from self-destruction. At the other end, the opposite end, there's one country which they're afraid is going to destroy the whole thing. The leader of the free world, the most powerful country in human history. It's quite a remarkable spectacle, and no less remarkable is the fact that there's no comment on it. In fact, as you mentioned, the conference itself was, I couldn't find any report. About 10 days later, you started seeing some references to it. But what happened there is pretty dramatic, and it may justify that headline in Der Spiegel about the end of the world, though not in the sense that they intended. My wife and I happened to be in Europe at the time, and the reaction there was mixed in an interesting way. For the kind of people we would tend to know, disbelief, horror, despair. Another sector was overjoyed. All of the ultra-right xenophobic elements which are trying to drive Europe towards some kind of almost neo-fascism, they were delighted. In fact, Trump's first contact was with Neil Farage, the head of the British UKIP, the right-wing xenophobic movement. And this is a pretty serious problem in Europe. So, for example, while the two of us, Valeria and I, were in France, the major political party, also called the Republican Party, Conservative Party, had its primary. And there are two candidates. One was Alain Juppé, who's a kind of a fairly respected right-wing political figure. He was defeated by a Fillon, François Fillon, who's an ultra-right xenophobe, which means that the socialists, meanwhile, have self-destructed. They're out of the game. So the coming election in France will be between an ultra-right xenophobic extremist who will be supported by the left. And the other candidate is Le Pen, who's the origin of her party is basically neo-fascist. That's France. A little more encouraging is what just happened in Austria. It was feared that the Trump effect would bring into power as president, a holder who comes from a neo-fascist origin, but it was the opposite. There was a reaction, unexpected, to the Trump victory, which apparently convinced fair number of voters, something like 8 or 10%, I think, to vote against the neo-fascist candidate and for the Green candidate. So we don't know what will happen, but the effect in Europe is quite interesting. However, what's significant here is the kind of blindness to what's actually taking place. And that was true all through the electoral campaign and the primary campaign. I mean, the primary campaign and the electoral campaign were pretty striking in many ways. There was almost no discussion of issues, even the most crucial issues, issues that just have never arisen in human history, like will organized human life survive, nuclear war, environmental catastrophe, practically nothing. The primaries, the Republican primaries, were quite striking in that every single candidate we've talked, so we don't have to go through that again, but it's true, just to repeat, because it is important, every single candidate, no exception, said we should do nothing about global warming. Most of them simply denied it's taking place. The moderates who said it's taking place said, yeah, but none of our business. We shouldn't do anything about it. That's the political party which has now taken over all three branches of government in the most powerful country in history, and that's the situation in which we now find ourselves with virtually no discussion.
Tens of millions of Bangladeshis are going to be climate refugees because of rising sea level and extreme weather. And the top Bangladeshi climate scientist that you quote says, these migrants should have the right to move to the countries from which all these greenhouse gases are coming. Millions should be able to go to the United States. Well, that's going to really play well here.
Actually, it got one sentence buried in the New York Times. Should have been a headline. I think that illustrates something quite significant about what's called the migrant crisis. Actually, Pope Francis put it pretty well. He said, migrants are not the cause of the crisis. They are the victims of the crisis. For the West, it's not a crisis. It's a moral crisis. Why do we regard it as a crisis if, 80,000 miserable victims come to a rich country like Austria with 8 million people? In fact, the leader in Europe, the one leader who has a kind of a respectable record on this, Angela Merkel in Germany, they've accepted, I think, 300,000 refugees. And meanwhile, refugees are being driven out. So one of the leading countries that's the leading recipients of refugees now is Afghanistan, because they're being expelled.
From Pakistan, primarily.
Partly there, but partly from the West. In the United States, of course, Obama has the worst record yet in deportation of people, most of whom are fleeing from the destructive impact of U.S. policies. There are countries that are accepting refugees. The champion is Lebanon, where about, I think, 40% of the population are refugees fleeing from one crime or another, recently from Iraq, Syria, and so on. That's a poor country which has no responsibility for generating refugees, and some of them go back to 1948, the expulsions at the time of the establishment of Israel.
Palestinian refugees
who are still in refugee camps, miserable camps. Jordan has accepted a huge number of refugees. Actually, Syria was accepting huge numbers before its self-suicidal implosion. But the rich countries, which have not only the capacity to absorb them, but also a significant responsibility in creating the conditions from which they're fleeing, they refuse to accept them. In fact, what both Europe and the United States are doing is trying to bribe someone else to keep the refugees. So Europe tried to make a deal with Turkey, which has a couple of million refugees, to keep refugees fleeing from the Syrian conflagration from Iraq. People are still fleeing from Iraq, from Afghanistan. Keep them in Turkey away from us and we'll bribe you. You know, we'll give you this and that. Erdogan is not my favorite person, but when he refers to European hypocrisy, it's pretty hard to deny it. We're doing exactly the same thing. If people are fleeing from the northern tier, the three countries that were really devastated by Reaganite atrocities, El Salvador, Guatemala, Guatemala goes way back, and Honduras, people fleeing from there, Mexico has to stop them from reaching our borders. It's their job. It's interesting that there's one country in the region from which refugees are not fleeing, Nicaragua. Why? Well, we don't have to mention it. It's the one country that the U.S. basically didn't run. The U.S. did carry out terror in Nicaragua. It was an attack on the government. In the other three countries, the terrorist forces supported by the United States were the government. I remember in Managua in 1985 or so, I was walking one evening with Cesar Jerez, who's the rector of the Jesuit University, a leading church figure in Central America. In fact, it had to flee from Guatemala, and El Salvador took refuge in Nicaragua. We happened to be walking down the street one evening, and a policeman was there, and we talked to him, and he pointed out to me that the one country in the region where you don't have to be terrified when you see a policeman is Nicaragua. There you have to be terrified of U.S. attacks. But they're not the source of refugees. And there's much more to say about that. But this is the migrant crisis is just a moral crisis in the West. But it's going to be huge, as you say, if tens of millions of people are fleeing Bangladesh, where are they going to go? This is what's right in front of our eyes at a time when all attention is given to Trump's Twitters.
In the wake of Trump's election, some have invoked Joe Hill's admonition, don't mourn, organize. What would be some ways to organize against Trump?
Well, first of all, some of Trump's initiatives, I think, should be supported, but supported in a way different from his proposal. So one of his main proposals is development of infrastructure in the United States. Infrastructure in the United States is a disaster. It's maybe one of the very few countries where you can't take a high-speed train. You know, so yes, reconstructing infrastructure, the collapsing bridges, roads, water supplies, energy system. If it was serious, it would mean solar energy and so on. All of this could be very important. So that's a policy that one should support. However, we should bear in mind that this is Obama's policy. It was killed by the Republican wrecking machine. When Obama came into office, they stated quite openly, Mitch McConnell, that our only goal is to make the country ungovernable. So that's our commitment. We'll make sure nothing happens and maybe somehow we'll get back in power. Well, now they're in power with a minority of votes, but nevertheless in power. So there's no reason why this should be blocked by Congress now. There are some reasons, but the main reason, make the country ungovernable, isn't there anymore. However, there are two major differences between Obama's original proposal, the kind of number of left economists and others, and the current one. One is that that one was undertaken at a time when it would not have had a fiscal cost. This one is being undertaken in the context of fiscal policies that Trump is taking over basically from Paul Ryan, who, in my view, is the most dangerous figure in American politics, for one thing, because he's taken seriously. But if you look at his fiscal policies and Trump's, it's a sharp tax cut for the rich and for the corporate sector. Of course, there's some talk about middle class relief, but that'll be marginal at best. no new sources of revenue. So major and huge buildup of the military system, what Trump calls our depleted military system, which is eons ahead of every country in the world, all of them together, but it's depleted, so we have to build it up. But at least so far, what Trump has described is not government stimulus. What it is taxpayer subsidy to private corporations to rebuild infrastructure, which they will own and profit from. So what if that's carried out, we're not going to find reconstruction of the decaying water systems or installing solar energy in houses and so on. What we're going to find is toll roads, for example, which the taxpayer will pay for with credits to the building corporations and which they will then profit from. Well, that's not the kind of infrastructure development that the country needs. But it fits the dedication of the Republican Party, and Trump in particular, to private power and the interests of the rest of the population is for rhetoric. You know, you can have some populist rhetoric, but meanwhile you kick them in the face. That's the policies. These can be supported with a progressive alternative. So when you ask what one should do about Trump's policies, I would say pursue them, but in a sensible way. Build popular support for a constructive version of these policies that the country really needs. And there are other respects, too, in which that could be the case. So, for example, his various comments about reducing tensions with Russia, let's say. Maybe he means it, maybe he doesn't, who knows. But it's the kind of thing that sensible people, certainly the progressive movement, should pursue. And we should recognize that there are real opportunities. I mean, just take a look at the popular vote. Clinton won by about 2.5 million votes. More significant among younger people, she won by a huge margin. And even more significant among younger people, Sanders won by an even bigger margin. That's hope for the future, if it can be organized and mobilized. And it can be. So going back to Joe Hill, that's just the right prescription.
And Trump got a lot of mileage attacking trade deals like NAFTA and the TPP, and that resonated with a lot of workers.
It did, but and there's a lot wrong with NAFTA and TPP, but not what he was pointing out. The problem with these so-called treaties, they're not actually these arrangements, is that they are not free trade agreements. Every reference to them refers to them as free trade agreements in the press, in the commentary, literature, and so on. They have almost nothing to do with trade, even less to do with free trade. They're highly protectionist. They're major, what's called intellectual property rights, provides, it's a right for monopolistic price gouging by huge mega corporations, pharmaceuticals, media conglomerates, and others. A crucial part of them is investor-state dispute mechanisms, which means investors, like a corporation, can sue a state because state actions, let's say regulations on emissions or whatever it may be, might harm future profits. These are investor rights agreements. The effect on trade is minimal. In fact, even what's called trade, to a large extent, isn't trade in any reasonable sense. Like, take the U.S. and Mexico. There's a lot of cross-border transactions which are called trade, but much of the, maybe 40-50% of it, roughly, is internal to major corporations. So it's internal to a command economy, like parts being made in Indiana and shipped to Mexico for assembly and sell it in Los Angeles. By any reasonable criterion, that's not trade. We didn't call it trade when things like that happened internal to the Soviet Union. It was internal to command economies, and that's a very high percentage. If you take a look at the TPP, Trans-Pacific, the tariffs among the major trading countries already extremely low, with a few exceptions, Japanese agriculture and so on, which means that any change would be minimal. In fact, even the most pro-TPP analyses concede that it would be in a couple of months worth of increase in GDP over years, so almost nothing. But the other consequences, the investor rights agreements, could be very significant. And there's another point about the TPP. A lot of the motive is geopolitical, to keep out China. This is part of Obama's pivot to Asia, anti-China efforts. With the TPP collapsing, as it's likely to do, that's going to lead to an interesting consequence. China has its own proposal for a China-based regional comprehensive trade agreement, and countries are flocking to that from South America to Australia to Japan and others. It'll isolate the United States, just as the United States was isolated at Marrakesh. It'll be isolated in the Asia-Pacific region. The China-based Asian Development Bank is infrastructure development banks, another case in point. The U.S. refused to join. Its allies joined, almost all of them, even England and so on. So that's this is all part of a conflict with China, which China is pursuing in commercial and trade ways and is winning out. The United States is already isolated in the Western Hemisphere to a remarkable degree. So what we're seeing throughout the world is quite an interesting development, where the U.S. is self-destructing in a certain way by increasingly isolating itself from the world. However, there's something else which isn't looked at much. The nature of the global economy is changing, especially in the last generation or so under the neoliberal globalization policies. So it's now becoming the case that a better measure of a nation's economic status, the traditional measure is gross domestic product, what's produced domestically, but a better measure increasingly is how much of the global economy is owned by corporations based in a particular country. These are corporations effectively subsidized by the citizens in many way, but their profit-making is global. Well, you take a look at that, it's a very interesting result. Turns out that U.S. companies own almost half the global economy. Practically every sector, the manufacturing, financial services, retail, U.S. corporations are way in the lead, not Chinese corporations, they're way behind. You take a look at the way it works in particular cases, you see what's going on. So take, say, Apple, most successful global corporation. It has a Taiwanese subsidiary, Foxconn, which organizes production in China. When you get an iPhone, it's called exported from China. But in fact, China gets a minuscule part of the profit. Foxconn gets a fair amount, and Apple gets about 10 times as much as Foxconn. That's the global economy. And you take a look back at it, the United States' economic hegemony is in some respects not unlike what was its peak after World War II, roughly half of global wealth, but now in the hands of private corporations.
You're listening to Noam Chomsky on Utopia. This is Alternative Radio. You can order copies of this program by calling 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
Now, when you say the U.S. is self-destructing, I mean, who do you mean by the U.S.? The owners and managers of the economy, the ruling class? Why would they do that?
One reason they don't mind is that their ownership of the world economy is overwhelming. So in what really matters, they're doing fine. The profits are booming. Their control of the global economy is enormous. On the other hand, there are things that are harmful to them, many. So, for example, take, say, the International Monetary Fund, IMF. It's been an instrument of the U.S. Treasury Department, meaning U.S. business, since its origins. But it's kicked out of a lot of areas of the world now. It's kicked out of East Asia. More dramatically, it's kicked out of South America, which is remarkable change. Now, South America used to be our little region over here. They do what we say. Now, no IMF, no treasury. Their loans are going to Europe at this point. That's an attack on U.S. economic hegemony. The isolation of the United States from, say, the Asia-Pacific-based developing geopolitical and economic system is harmful to them. They're still producing in China and making a ton of money out of it, but losing a lot of power and control. And these developments, I think, are extremely significant, and the U.S. basic core establishment doesn't like them at all. That's why they were wary about Trump. Actually, they're pretty happy now because what he's doing, exactly opposite to the campaign pledges, is bringing in the core of the financial establishment that he was attacking. So the people who are in the top positions come straight out of Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan Chase, and so on. And if you look at stocks, you see the understanding of the business community. So very quickly after the election, stocks in energy corporations, banks, and so on just shot up. One of the most striking was Peabody Coal, biggest coal producer, which was actually in bankruptcy proceedings. But their stock immediately went up, stock value went up by about 50%, even more later. Those are all reflections of what the business world expects the actual policies to be. Deregulation, which means laying the basis for the next financial crisis, which the taxpayer will have to bail everyone out for again. And energy corporations means destruction of the environment, military production, stocks go way up, we know what that means. These are all portents for the future, but they also carry with them opportunities. All of this can be constrained, controlled, reversed, directed in other ways. And in fact, take, say, the white male working class Trump voters. A fair number of them voted for Obama in 2008. And they voted for Obama for a reason. The slogan of that campaign was hope and change. And they quite rightly demand change, seriously. 2008, a year before, that's the crash. A year before the crash, so no crash, you know, economists hailing the great economy. 2007, U.S. workers, non-supervisory workers, had salaries, wages lower than in 1979, before these neoliberal policies were instituted. So the call for change makes a lot of sense. Hope, of course. Well, they didn't get any hope. They didn't get any change. So now they voted for a con man who's making the same promises. But that's an opportunity to provide a real program for hope and change that would be meaningful, could bring together many of the people who voted for Trump and the Sanders voters, for example. These are opportunities that can be pursued.
The economist John Kenneth Galbraith called unions a countervailing power vis-a-vis corporate power. 50 years ago, 1 in 3 workers were union members. Today, it's 1 in 10. What can be done to revive the union movement?
I think we have an answer to that from history. So go back to the last period in U.S. history that was similar to the recent neoliberal miracle, the 1920s, okay? Very similar in many ways, increasing inequality, financial speculation, a lot of euphoria among the very wealthy, and the labor movement crushed. There was a militant, active labor movement in the United States. Its leaders were jailed. Its political organization, the Socialist Party, was smashed by mobs. The union movement was practically decimated by Wilson's Red Scare. Unions were in such a weak position that even right-wing visitors from England and Australia were amazed at the attacks on U.S. workers. Well, something happened in the 30s. The movement reconstructed. It developed. The CIO was organized. There was a militant labor action leading up to sit-down strikes, which are very frightening to management because they're one step before just taking over the factory, saying we'll run it ourselves. You know, that led to, that was the basis for Roosevelt's, he was sympathetic, which is of course significant, but it was the motive force for the New Deal legislations, which softened the edges of the Depression, in many ways instituted programs which are of, remain of considerable benefit. But the labor movement became a powerful force, and I don't see why that can't happen again. It's going to be different this time. Then it was manufacturing-based. This time it's not going to be because the economy's changed.
Well, let's talk about what's called the gig economy, the emerging precariat, as it were, the loss of vanishing steady 9-to-5 jobs with, you know, some benefits, maybe some sick leave, maybe some a couple of weeks paid vacation. Those are becoming distant memories as this gig economy of temporary work develops, hiring on demand. And supposedly workers feel are supposed to feel good. They're now independent contractors. I guess you see a lot of this in, you know, universities and colleges where so many adjuncts and TAs and temps are hired.
Well, the one of the things that's happened during this neoliberal era is increased imposition of a kind of business model on the universities. Which includes policies of the kind you described, hiring temporary workers with no security and rotten working conditions and very low wages, but you can kick them out if anytime you want, instead of tenured faculty who will be supported for research, teaching, and so on. It's a loss for the working people, it's a loss for the students, but it's good for the bottom line. It's cheaper. And it means people live in a precarious condition, the precariat, which frightens them. It separates them from one another. They're not working together. They're, as you say, called individual contractors. They're not, of course, but they're called that, like Walmart employees are called associates. Same sort of thing. But they're separated from one another. They're focused on their individual security, which is in danger all the time. They have no security for future life. They can't plan. And that means they might well be unorganized and not participants in a functioning democratic society, all of which is quite valuable for concentrated power in elite hands. They don't want a democratic functioning society. They want a society of people who are frightened, intimidated, inactive, trying to save what they can and fearing for the next paycheck. You know? In fact, it's kind of even public doctrine. Alan Greenspan, when he was hailed as St. Alan, you know, the great, greatest economist ever, when he was testifying to Congress about the success of the economy he was running, he said frankly and with pride that it's based on growing worker insecurity. If working people are insecure, they're not going to ask for higher wages, they're not going to ask for benefits because they're too insecure, they're not going to go on strike, and that means profits will go up. Control will be more in the hands of management. There'll be greater inequality. That's a healthy economy. That's what he was praised for. So this is all part of it. It's true that for individuals who are in this kind of a job market, the opportunity to drive a taxi in your spare time may be valuable, but the social, economic, political consequences are very harmful.
During the presidential campaign, there was virtually no mention of the poor in this country. There was a lot of focus on the middle class. I must say, during the primary season, Bernie Sanders did talk about the poor, but they're going to come out on the short end of the stick once again with proposed cuts in Medicaid, in Head Start, in Pell Grants, in food stamps, and a whole bunch of other anti-poverty programs. Why are the poor so marginalized politically?
Because they're powerless. They're powerless, unorganized. By definition, they don't have wealth. They're trying to survive. Remember, a lot of it is color-related. That's the population of color, immigrants, single mothers. For them to organize and act is extremely difficult, so it's easy to disregard them. And they're not totally disregarded. There's a very interesting study by Arlie Hochschild. She's a very interesting sociologist. She lived for 5 or 6 years in one of the in a Tea Party stronghold in Louisiana, and just trying to get to understand the point of view of the people there. She wanted to solve what she describes as a great paradox, the same one Thomas Frank and others have talked about. The people are voting for representatives who are trying to destroy them. So these are people who care about the environment, which is being destroyed. They live around a bayou. They hunt and they fish and have all kind of memories of a wonderful life in a lush environment. It's all being destroyed by petrochemical plants. This is kind of a cancer alley, and everybody's dying of cancer. They hate it. They're angry. They don't want to see their lives destroyed. And they vote for people who want to increase the damage. That's the paradox. I'm just trying to understand it. And it comes out with an interesting image that she says the people there accepted as their picture of things. They see themselves as standing in a line. They've worked hard all their lives. They did all the right things. They went to church. They studied the Bible. They had families. You know, the husband went to work. The wife stayed home, took care of the kids. They did everything right, just as their parents did. And they were slowly moving forward in line. That's the American dream. All of a sudden, the line has stalled. That's the neoliberal period. They're about where they were 25 and 30 years ago, maybe even worse. Ahead of them in line, people are going off into the stratosphere, super wealth. But that doesn't bother them, because the imagery of the American dream is that if you work, if you have merit, you're supposed to gain. And these people, maybe they're a bunch of gangsters and robbers, but they're supposed to have merit, so that's fine. What bothers them is the people behind them, the poor, the people you were talking about, people, the worthless people who haven't worked hard and who haven't gotten to their point. And all of a sudden, the federal government comes in and takes those people and puts them ahead of them in line. That's the programs you were talking about. That's mythology, but, you know, there's enough particles of truth scattered in the mythologies, you can make it look credible. So Ronald Reagan's welfare queens are, you know, going to the welfare office in their limousines and stealing your pay. We don't like that. And it's the federal government that's doing it. Same with Pell Grants, same with you know, food stamps, the whole range of things. They're taking these immigrants, these African-Americans, these Latinos, all these people who scrounge. It's the makers and the takers, you know, again, the Romney image, and the role of the federal government is to take those people behind us who haven't worked the way we did and lived the kind of decent, sober lives that we have and put them ahead of us. So they hate the federal government. They're being devastated by pollution from the chemical plants, petrochemical plants and others. But their image of the EPA is some guy in a business suit who comes down here and tells me I'm not allowed to fish, but he doesn't do anything about those plants. And in fact, the state regulators in Louisiana are beyond non-existence. All of this fits together with religious beliefs, and there's elements of white supremacy, patriarchal commitments, and so on. All of this works together with an economic base that is real to lead to a resolution of the paradox with a kind of internal logic, which is significant. There's an internal logic which makes some sense, even though in the broader context it's self-destructive. Well, those are opportunities for organizing, too. That can be changed.
But then you encounter, or at least I sense, a real class divide between, if I may say, people like us, you know, who may drink bottled water and, you know, eat organic arugula versus people who are left with white bread and potato chips.
Well, the people she's living with are not left with potato chips. They are, the people she's trying to understand are not the poor. They're poorer than they were. These are people who are, they have maybe jobs in the petrochemical industry. They have homes, they have cars. The people who are really poor on the potato chips are the ones behind them, the worthless ones, who the government is putting ahead of them. But they themselves, you know, they have families, the lives are centered around church and church activities, you know, the homes. Not like it was. They're not getting ahead. They think the dream is beyond them and their children, but they're not starving. That's not the group. That's not the Tea Party. Tea Party is lower middle class, small, a lot of them small businessmen, people like that. Yes, there is a class difference between the professional classes who are protected by the trade agreements, for example, and who often are getting ahead, and these lower middle class, small business people who used to have, and maybe still do have, manufacturing and other jobs, pipe fitters, you know, welders, things like that. There's a big class difference also in kind of ideals in what we think is important. Like, is it important for gays to have rights? For what you describe as people like us, yes, they should. But for people like that, that's an attack on their values. And they don't see the significance of that when their own lives are being undermined by destruction of the bayou, by corporations digging into salt domes, which lead to the huge destruction of the region. As compared with that, gay rights don't mean anything.
I was looking at the Populist Party platform of 1892 in Omaha, quite a document called for nationalization of railroads and steamship lines, nationalization of telephone and telegraph systems. How would you characterize what is called populism today?
That was the original populist movement. It was a movement of radical farmers, started in Texas, went to Kansas, right through the Midwest. This was a period in American history where the agrarian society was being marginalized in favor of capitalist industrialization, actually state capitalist industrialization. These were people who were being strangled by northern finance, by bankers, by you know, merchants. So they were forced to work within their system, highly exploitative. These are people who maintain the individualist Republican conception that a person is free only if they have no one giving them orders. So wage labor was considered not all that different from slavery. It was temporary. You could get out of it. And out of that background came a radical populist movement, which also they developed their own cooperative structure, their own marketing structures, all sorts of things. And they were moving towards efforts to unify with the growing industrial organized working class, which was just developing at the time, like Knights of Labor. That was right into the 1890s. Well, it was crushed, partially by force. But it was the most democratic movement in American history. That was populism then. It later degenerated into racism, xenophobia, antisemitism, and so on. But the origins were quite significant and highly progressive. It was part of the background for the progressive movement of the early part of the 20th century, you know, trust busting, that sort of thing. What's called populism today is something quite different. It means opposition to established institutions, which can take all kinds of forms. It could be neo-Nazism, it could be highly leftist and progressive.
Talk about the resistance that the Standing Rock Sioux have generated over the last many months. It's still not resolved. Supposedly the Army Corps of Engineers is going to reroute the pipeline.
No,
but
they're going to study rerouting of the pipeline. And the Trump administration has already said we'll disregard it.
Well, in any case, the oil is going to come out of the ground, which all the environmentalists from Bill McKibben on, Naomi Klein, say it's got to stay in the ground. But look at this broad coalition that kind of coalesced around clearly one of the most oppressed minorities in this country, the Native Americans. It was very interesting that the activists also had an economic component to their program of trying to stop the pipeline, and that is to close out bank accounts, the banks that were supporting this project, like J.P. Morgan Chase, like Wells Fargo, like Citibank, like Bank of America. They took a bit of a financial hit.
Symbolically, yeah. If you look at the bottom line, it's not a real hit. But it's true that many interests have converged. The native rights treaties that are being, again, broken, the local environmental effects, like what will the effect be in the local area if the pipeline, you know, goes under this valuable water or other source. And then there's the general point that you mentioned. The oil should stay in the ground. And unfortunately, even if the pipeline's rerouted, which doesn't look too likely, the oil's not going to stay in the ground. In fact, at the same time that this very impressive and significant demonstration is taking place with support of veterans, citizens groups, and others, at the very same time, take a look at the business pages. The energy corporations have discovered a new frontier for oil exploration in the Gulf of Mexico, which is going to be a bonanza for Mexico and contribute massively to destruction of future life. That's going on at the same time.
I should add that the so-called progressive Prime Minister of Canada, Justin Trudeau, has just okayed the Kinder Morgan pipeline from the tar sands in Alberta out to British Columbia. It's the 500th anniversary of Thomas More's utopia, you know, where he imagined a perfect island nation where people lived in peace and harmony. If you were to close your eyes for a moment, what kind of society should we have?
We should have a free, democratic society where people participate in the decisions that matter to them for their own lives and elsewhere. They should be in control of social, economic, political institutions. Working stakeholders, workers and communities should run, manage, organize enterprises. There should be a free associations, making arrangements with one another at from the local to the international level, searching for focusing crucially on the basic problems that really are problems of survival, like nuclear war and environmental disaster, but an educated, informed, organized population participating and controlling all of the institutions of the social and economic system and political system. That's what we should be looking for. Nobody's going to construct it, but we can move towards it in many ways.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, bye.
That was Noam Chomsky on Utopia. I talked with him in his office at MIT. Noam Chomsky, the legendary MIT professor, has been a leading voice for peace and social justice for many decades. The New Statesman calls him the conscience of the American people. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado, part of the nonprofit media education organization Rise Up. We are independent and supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the corporate media, such as Ralph Nader, Naomi Klein, Michelle Alexander, Richard Wolff, and Chris Hedges. And since its inception, AR has recorded and archived Noam Chomsky's work. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for a CD, MP3, or written transcript of today's program, Noam Chomsky on Utopia, call us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our website, alternativeradio.org. The Kronos Quartet performs our theme music. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.